Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Andrew Goldner. I'm one of the founders of GrowthX, and we're a Silicon Valley-based venture capital fund that works with founders to help them find product market fit. And in the process, we find qualified investment opportunities.
Andrew, thanks so much for making time joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we jump in and spend a great time talking about all the things you guys are building with your current fund, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
A thumbnail version. Well, it's extended over 20 years. It's definitely been nonlinear, but I think it's added up to doing exactly, you know, what I'm doing now with my partners. I started my career when the internet was first commercializing. I came out of law school as a corporate lawyer and landed in New York City during that exciting time. And in the process, discovered that the kind of transactional law that I wanted to practice was 100% about this growing internet and at the time, you know, e-commerce and media opportunity. When I graduated law school, I obviously knew very little about what it was like to be a lawyer, but I knew how the internet worked. And that really gave me the opportunity to focus and really take the ride that we saw happen in the mid to late 90s and kind of ebb and flow since then. I like a lot of attorneys, after working at a private practice, went in-house to a company called DoubleClick. We ended up getting acquired by Google. I ended up then, you know, joining a wealthy family in Canada, the Thompson family, that competed with Bloomberg for the attention of financial market and legal professionals, and did sophisticated fintech transactions for them. In the process of doing that, a group of us, you know, pitched the idea of having Thompson start their own news business. Unlike Bloomberg, that had, as most people know, their own news business, Thompson didn't have that. They licensed their news business from third parties like Dow Jones. And so we actually started a news business at Thompson to compete with the likes of Dow Jones and Bloomberg. And that ended up leading to the acquisition by Thomson of Reuters. And when they came together and formed Thomson Reuters, I became a publisher of Reuters News. I spent my time in that, you know, role really doing two things: bringing innovation and the voice of the customer into the newsroom. You know, again, very closely associated with what I do now with startups. I did that for many, many years, and did that also in Asia and Pacific and the Middle East. I lived over in Hong Kong and Singapore for many, many years. And when I returned back to the United States, I went right to the belly of the beast and into Silicon Valley, and decided that I wanted to start my own thing. And in the process, you know, met people, you know, met different opportunities, thought about whether I wanted to start my own company or join an early stage company of someone else's. And so began doing that quite a bit when I was in Silicon Valley, joined companies, angel invested in companies, mentored founders, became advisor to companies, really as a way to determine what I wanted to do as a next step. I founded a company with a dear friend of mine during that time that was in the impact investing space. And then along the journey, you know, had the pleasure of meeting my co-founders, and we started GrowthX in 2014.
Well, that's super exciting. What a journey you've had so far. So, you know, congrats on all the great success, and definitely paints the picture on your journey into venture capital, which one of my questions that I was going to ask, but you addressed that. In terms of what really fascinates me, as I talk to a lot of fund managers and those that are in venture capital, that journey for your fund one formation, as you guys had started, I believe you said 2014.
Correct.
In terms of really defining your investment thesis, your strategy, and then setting out and start, you know, the fundraising route, you know, the journey of where, you know, pitching to LPs. Tell us a little bit more about that experience. What were some of the challenges that you had encountered? And just basically tell us a little bit more about that process.
Well, you know, for us, we arrived at the decision to start a fund because the way that we were helping founders was frankly giving us very serious and reliable insights about the health and wellness of the company from the perspective of the behavior of the founders and the behavior of the market. Something, and we were doing something that very few people were doing and very few people knew how to do. And it was generating insights. And for us at the time, you know, we felt like the insights that we were generating from helping these founders go to market was so much more valuable and so much more reliable than what you might glean during a 2-minute demo day pitch, or even over a few conversations with a startup founder. And so the idea of launching the fund was a pretty obvious one to us. You know, one of my co-founders, Will Bunker, who founded what became Match.com and then spent many years as a very active angel investor, was one of the first to recognize this with us, because he was already angel investing and he knew why his portfolio company in certain instances weren't performing well. And it wasn't because they needed more money. It was because they wasted the money he had given them, and they wasted it building features that nobody wanted. You know, they wasted it spending it entirely on features and functions and products and not thinking about problems and the people who had it and the markets that they wanted to serve. And ultimately that's where product market fit comes from. And so when we decided to raise our fund, it really was reverse engineering who we thought the story would be most attractive to. You know, we joked at the time, and in fact, we still stand by it, that really what GrowthX has is the only form of legal insider trading in America. I mean, ultimately, that's what we had in a private market. We were inside a company. We were helping them find product market fit. And we saw things before anybody else did. And by helping them, we earned the right to invest in them. And we invested in them based on the things that we knew that other people didn't know. And we thought that was a very smart way of investing. And for many of our LPs, they looked at it as early stage private equity. And for the limited partners of our fund who got that, it was a good fit to invest in us because they appreciated what we were doing and why it gave a competitive advantage, not only to earn the right to invest in competitive deals, but to be able to also create value and downstream investment opportunities, you know, based on the help that we were providing. And so, you know, from that perspective, it was straightforward. But, you know, raising a fund, just like raising a round as a startup, is never a straightforward and easy opportunity. It's a lot of conversations. It's a lot of travel. And, you know, the advice that we took, that we always give our founders, is start by determining, based on who you are and what you're doing and how you want to go about doing what you're doing, who would be the right fit for you as an investor, and then go find them. Don't just try to speak with any investor who will speak with you or take every call from an investor who reaches out to you, right? And so in the language of market development, we call that developing your ideal customer profile. And in the language of raising a fund, or for a startup raising capital, we call that defining your ideal investor profile. And so for us, part of the challenge was defining the characteristics of the people who we thought, based on what we were doing and how we were doing it, would be the most interested in what we were doing. And so, for example, from the outset of our fund in 2014, we determined that we were going to give our investors unlimited direct investment rights without a charging them additional fee as in the form of a management fee or carried interest. And at the time, that was bleeding edge. You know, and many of my colleagues in the venture world thought we were being too generous and naive in doing that. But it was part of the story we were telling, and it was part of how we were going about, you know, helping startups and bringing in pools of capital. And so naturally, we had to think about who are the partners in funds, who are the investors in funds that also want direct investment rights. If you're a true institutional, traditional limited partner that isn't interested and doesn't even potentially have the right to directly invest in the companies, well, then our offer of unlimited direct investment rights with no additional fee or carry attached is going to fall flat. And so, you know, part of our process and part of the challenge was determining the characteristics of the investor who would be interested in our story and the way that we're going about building and serving our fund.
How long did that take? Just curious, from an idea to closing.
I mean, it takes forever. You know, what a lot of startups don't appreciate is that the investors they're pitching are also pitching always. You know, in the simplest of terms, being a VC is just, you know, is just a marketplace. You know, we are raising money and spending money and spending money and raising money nearly constantly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think like a lot of first-time fund managers, you know, we got our start based on pre-existing relationships and it snowballed from there. And so we, you know, we were blessed to have some early anchor VC tenants based on the pre-existing relationships that the partners had. But it's a long process. And I have to tell you too, that even though we're only talking about temporarily, you know, seven and a half years ago, it feels like a lifetime in our industry. So much has changed. You know, our, you know, relatively unique and certainly differentiated approach as venture capitalists at the time is not as revolutionary in 2021. I think our sole focus and our expertise now with a developed SaaS platform to back it up to help founders do one thing and one thing alone, and that's find the truth about where their product fits in the market, is still relatively unique in this world. But what's changed is you, and it's wonderful, is you have so many more different, interesting fund models and approaches than you did in 2014. And so in many ways, you know, we follow the same adoption curve that Jeffrey Moore popularized in Crossing the Chasm as any founder introducing an innovative new piece of technology. At the time, we were very much speaking with early adopters because what we were doing as a fund was quite different and in many ways innovative. And by definition, the only people that do business with new and unproven things are, you know, classically, you know, in kind of that bucket early adopter, you know, and, you know, whether they're an innovator or an early adopter, that kind of generic bucket of early adopter. And so it's different now.
Yeah, absolutely. No, those are definitely very interesting observations. When we talk, I'm sure, you know, I'm an angel investor myself as well, and I have an SPV where a group of us that we invest together, and we've had our great deal of anti-portfolio, the misses, the companies that we really wanted to invest in, we missed them, or we passed on them for whatever the reasons. And it always fascinates me to talk to people about the learnings, kind of the lessons learned from your anti-portfolio or the misses that you had experienced. Share with us those. Not so much interested in the actual companies that you've missed, but what did you learn and how did that, if at all, impacted your investment strategy or your investment thesis?
I think it's a great question. I mean, our first fund was purposefully a proof of concept fund. You know, we knew we had a differentiated approach and we were going to stick to that, you know, which is using our expertise at bringing products to market as a way to both earn deals we might not get otherwise and de-risk deals that we are in. We knew that was going to be our single differentiation, but we didn't know whether we were going to be B2B or B2C, whether we were going to be software or hardware, whether they're going to be deep tech, whether we're going to be, you know, applied technology versus developed technology. And so our first fund was very much proof of concept. And I think we absolutely learned. And that's why coming out the other side of that and raising our second fund, which we're investing out of now, is we've settled on, you know, capitally efficient, highly scalable, which, you know, mostly means B2B SaaS. It doesn't have to, but that's pretty much what it typically means. Because if you think about in 2021, what's, you know, the most capitally efficient, highly scalable, it's B2B SaaS. You know, B2C is effectively a large and complicated marketing challenge. And as we know, solving them can create enormous amounts of wealth, but they're capitally intense because marketing challenges take time and money to solve relative to B2B SaaS. And again, it doesn't have to be SaaS. You know, we're not afraid of transactional revenue, but rather than it being episodic and completely unpredictable revenue, you know, we work with companies that have SaaS plus transaction, where the transaction can, you know, really be seen as, you know, having some of the characteristics of predictability. As an investor that I've gotten to know, in Nashville likes to say, instead of recurring, it's reoccurring, yeah. Right? Or as he also talks about SaaSifying your transactional revenue. I think that's a really smart way of talking about it. It's still transactional revenue. No one's going to say otherwise. But if you do a cohort analysis of it and you can see how it builds and maintains and can be somewhat predictable, you'll get more credit. You'll get a better multiple. You'll get a better exit based on that. And so, yeah, that was part of the learning for us, was through the journey, being able to see how we can apply what we do in a way that creates the outcomes and the timeframes that we want to create them for our investors and our founders. And, you know, deep tech or hardware, which is more capitally intense, or other initiatives that, let's say, have regulatory hurdles, the path to product market fit looks exactly the same regardless of product or market, but it elongates when you have something that's more capitally intense or when you have things that have regulatory hurdles. And so our ability to have our impact at the time we wanted, with, by the way, the size of our fund and the size of the checks we write at the stage that we write them at, we learned that, you know, capital efficient, highly scalable is where we wanted to focus.
Yeah, very interesting. And thank you for sharing that. And just to add a little bit more to that, based on our research that we've done, and actually from personal experience, being a founder operator of multiple companies, as a first-time founder, we've noticed a trend that a lot of founders, they start in the B2C, the D2C sector, where it's a consumer-based product. Yeah. And if you're a serial entrepreneur and multiple companies launched, a lot of the founders focus on that B2B enterprise solution sector. So that's a very interesting observation, kind of confirms my own bias, yeah, as I invest and talk to a lot of founders from that perspective. Yeah. But definitely thank you for sharing that. In terms of portfolio construction, share with us just your thoughts on how do you go about that when it comes to just any of the reserves or the follow-on, or, you know, anything that you have to do with, you know, maybe a spinoff. If you see a company going through a hyper growth and just going outside of the fund to invest in that, just share your perspectives on the portfolio construction.
Yeah, I mean, my perspective as, you know, as fund manager, is that, you know, it's important to invest heavily in your winners. Now, the beauty of the venture capital asset class is you can talk to a dozen upper decile performing general partners and maybe get 12 different versions of an answer to the question you just asked. And so I don't mean to imply that I'm right and there's only one way, because it's multivariate, and with multivariate comes complexity. But for me and the work that I've done and what I've seen, you know, we think that making sure that you have reserves to follow on with your winners are important, because ultimately, with the amount of capital being raised these days, right? And this is part of what formed our personal thesis. What the amount of capital that's being raised these days over significantly additional rounds, meaning the stacked preferences are getting more complicated because there's so many more different series of shares with different rights, both with ownership and control rights and liquidity rights. Those stacked preferences over time mean that, and because of the size of venture capital, right, the amount of assets under management that are being deployed right now at the early stage, and therefore what's happening to valuation, and therefore what's happening to my ownership target, and my ability to see a venture return with a certain ownership target with more rounds of higher rounds of financing being had after I invest, really just comes down to some mathematics. It's not just the, to me, the fairly obvious statement that where winners emerge, you want to put more money in. You have to have the right to put those that money in. And it's not just a legal right. I mean, you may have heard from other guests or your work that kind of the notion of the death of the pro rata right, right? A pro rata right is a contractual right that you have, you know, a presumably legally enforceable contract where someone has given your fund, right? Part of what you bought was the right of first refusal. So that when they raise additional financing, you have the right to give them more money and protect whatever percent ownership you have now going forward. Yep. But with venture becoming so much more competitive and some of the behaviors of downstream funders changing, if that startup is faced with the choice of taking funding from a new fund that they really want to take, but having to tell the previous investors, I'm sorry, you know, you're going to have to agree to forfeit your pro rata rights in order for us to close this new round of financing. You know, that's a non-obvious, you know, a scenario and a tough decision. And so it's not enough that you just have a right to protect your pro rata. I think you have to be a strong and value-added player that the founder is willing to go to bat for, and or the downstream investors are interested in having you continue along on the journey. And so for us, that and more add up to, we have to be thinking about not only capital reserves, but also the work that we're doing and the relationship we have with our founders and our co-investors to make sure that when push comes to shove, you know, we're not shoved out. And so that's part of how we think about our portfolio. But of course, listen, we, you know, our asset class follows the power law. The Monte Carlo simulation looks the same for us as other venture capitalists at our stage. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at the relative percent likelihood of a certain outcome of the fund based on the size of the portfolio, that also begins to complicate decision, because that also complicates how much your investment and whether you have reserves and how much reserves that you have. And so For those of us that do it and love it, it's part of the challenge of deciding how you want to practice the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely very interesting observations from that perspective. And you've mentioned value add investor, which is a fascinating area for me as a founder and also as an investor. Balancing that, finding that perfect medium, always kind of keeping in the back of my head that I need to be a friend to this founder, not a parent. I think it's just interesting dynamics how a lot of those relationships work. And one of the best pieces of advice that I've received as I was launching my own companies throughout the years or been an executive Fortune 500 is that majority of my time I'm going to spend on recruiting and bringing the top talent. It's the hardest piece of the equation. It's always challenging and you should spend a lot of time on that. I should have taken that advice a lot seriously sooner before I actually understood the value of that. When it comes to you collaborating or working with your portfolio companies, your portfolio founders, when it comes to attracting the top talent to their teams, I would imagine that's a challenge, especially in this current market conditions where there's, you know, the war for talent is real. What are some of the recommendations, or maybe practical recommendations, that you provide to your founders to succeed in that space, to really win that war on talent acquisition and surround themselves with the top talent?
Well, I do agree that talent risk is a real risk at the early stage. I also agree that currently it is a war on talent. I don't disagree with that macro view. I don't think the fundamentals change. And for us, we think about it as practically as we can. And obviously, like anyone, you know, we'll use our brand and our network in the favor of our founders as best as we can. But at the end of the day, traction speaks louder than words. And it speaks louder than words in every situation, whether you're pitching a VC or trying to onboard top talent. Top talent, by definition, has options, right? They're good at what they do. They're in high demand. They have options, and right? And so why are they going to choose you, right? And for us, you know, being able to show them that this is real and it's sustainable, that you're solving a real market problem, that you're not just tinkering in a laboratory, and that traction speaks loudly. You're de-risking the opportunity and communicating to top talent that this is a bet that they should make, because again, they have options. Why are they going to choose you? Obviously, a big part of it is going to be the behavior of the founding team. You know, I'm a big fan that everything communicates, right? The corollary is you can't not communicate. Everything communicates. So it's one thing for a founder to tell top talent about what their vision is and how they behave and what the culture is, but everything communicates. And so doing the things that are received as a communication by top talent to influence them to choose you versus someone else is very, very important. For us, though, again, we try to stay in our lane and be better at it than anybody. And helping early stage founders to follow a capitally efficient and proven framework to find the truth about whether and where their product fits in the market is part of how you attract downstream talent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just another concept that's very unique, and I always try to revert back to that, is what is that unique kind of that unfair advantage that you have as a founder? What is that unfair advantage that I have as an investor that really, you know, will allow me to help you succeed and go to the next level? I think those are very interesting observations that you're sharing. When it comes to that very initial meeting, that first meeting with the founders as you get to know them, What are some of the favorite questions that you love to ask? And I don't mean it from a perspective of, you know, well, let me ask tough questions and see if I can trip them up. But you don't come across as the person that really does that, by instead investing in building that relationship and see if we can be attached at the hip for the next 10 years and win together. What are some of the questions that really help you uncover those dynamics as you get to know the founders initially?
Fair enough. And I really appreciate the question. I'll answer it in two ways. What I can tell you is that of all the questions we're asking, what we're driving towards, and yeah, we're not looking to trip someone up, that this is not a game. What we're in search of is the number one thing that we look for when we're investing in someone. And that is that person and that team, they're know-it-alls. They're learn-it-alls, not know-it-alls. We invest in learn-it-alls. We don't invest in know-it-alls. Okay, and we all know what the difference is. You know, it may not be a term you've heard before, but you kind of know where I'm driving, right?
But I like it. I like it a lot. And I'm going to shamelessly steal that probably.
Please do. It's a term we coined many years ago, and it just never stops working. Yeah. Be a learn-it-all, right? And so what we're looking for as we begin that first conversation with founders is this person, is this team a learn-it-all or a know-it-all? Ultimately, that's what we're looking for. We're not looking to be right. We're not looking for you to be right or wrong. We're looking to understand how you process information, what motivates you, and how you're going to go about this nearly impossible task that you've set yourself on, right? And learn-it-alls win, know-it-alls don't. That's our view. Now, my favorite question, again, because I'm looking to learn. Everything communicates. I'm looking to learn. You can tell me that customer development is important. You can tell me that you're prioritizing market development as much as you are product development, but everything communicates. And oftentimes it's not the words you choose to share, but your actions, your inactions. My favorite question that any founder who's pitching GrowthX Capital can expect to be asked at some point during their pitch is the following. Let's say it's 3 p.m. When we're meeting together. I'll ask the founder what time they got up. Let's say it was 7 a.m. Okay, I want you to right now account for every tenth of every hour between when you woke up and now. That's every 6 minutes, right? As a lawyer, I had to keep track in a diary of every 6 minutes of every day in order to create bills for our clients. You're going to go through that exercise now for me, but it's just today. I want you to account for in detail every 6 minutes of today from when you woke up to today, when you're sitting with me now. And in every one of those 6 minutes, I want you to share with me the actual and literal things that you were doing to get money from your customer's bank account into your bank account. And if you quote predictable revenue, I'm going to punch you in the throat. Right? I don't want to hear what you learned at that Saster. I don't want you to learn what you just read in that blog. That's all high level. It's not practical. It's not tactical. I want to know literally the steps you have taken, the actual things you've done to get customer from a client's bank account into yours. Go. That's my question, right? That communicates loud and clear. And of course, you may or may not be surprised to learn just how few minutes between when they woke up and when they're meeting with me, they can really enunciate in literal detail the actual things that they were doing to get money from their customer's bank account into theirs. Now, if I asked that question, but what I wanted them to do is account for every 6 minutes on what they were doing to develop their product, it would be a very different answer. And by the way, a lot of it is no fault of the founder. They are equipped to answer the question about product development because Heroku, because GitHub, right? Because Ruby on Rails, because of computer science degrees, because of product development boot camps, because of low-code, no-code tools, right? Because of frameworks and languages and everything that's been developed over the last 2 to 3 decades to enable more founders, more places to go to product more efficiently. That hasn't happened with go-to-market. There is no Ruby on Rails of market development. There is no Heroku of biz dev. There is no GitHub of sales. There are computer science degrees and no sales degrees. There's not even sales classes. And for every one of the product development boot camps you see that litter the globe, I challenge you to find a single market development boot camp. Right. These things don't exist. So the reason they can't do the work and can't express to me what they've done is because no one's showing them how to do it. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it's an important question to understand how they value and how they prioritize market development versus product development. And again, you can tell me you prioritize it, but when you just showed me that you spend only 7% of your entire day doing it, that communicates pretty loud and clear.
How much do you rely or trust that initial gut reaction? When we meet people for the first time, we you know, human nature, we always make some initial judgments.
Yeah.
How much do you try not to.
I mean, I try not to. I'm a fallible human being. Uh-huh. And so I spend most of my day making mistakes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, subconscious bias is a very real and dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And that's part of what drives gut reactions is subconscious bias, conscious bias as well.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it can have, you know, it can be a a bias or reaction simply because I'm not sitting in a place of optimal performance based on my range of performance abilities because I didn't get enough sleep or I had an argument with somebody or I haven't eaten healthy or I haven't exercised. And so I think we really need to be aware of what motivates and demotivates us to that point of optimal performance and our range of performance abilities. And I think we have to be very aware of conscious and subconscious bias. And so making snap decisions is a very dangerous thing to do. Mm-hmm. You miss opportunities that are very valuable and you exclude people who should be a part of the opportunity. And I don't know what the answer is to be able to do that. I certainly don't do it without fail. I mean, I'm as susceptible as the next person to make those types of mistakes. What I try to do to stack the odds in my favor is be considerate of the person that I'm going to be meeting with because I recognize that they're valuable and their time is valuable as well. And so if I haven't gotten the exercise, if I'm not well, if I'm at a performance ability that's suboptimal, maybe I need to reschedule. One, two, you know, make sure that I'm not taking the meetings alone, making sure that there's someone there holding accountable. And if they can't be there with me to do the meeting with me and see something from a different light that I can be alerted all about, make sure that I have a process that sheds transparency on the decision-making. And so one of the things that we do and have done for a long time at GrowthX is we make decisions about investments pretty transparently. We invite founders into that decision-making process. So rather than, you know, squirreling ourselves away every Monday afternoon for the hallowed partner meeting where we decide who gets funded and who doesn't, and then we come down from the mountain and make those pronouncements wearing our Patagonia vests and using language that's meant purposely to obfuscate, we actually go inside and allow the founders to come inside our investment decision-making process to hold us accountable and for transparency. Right. This is how we make decisions. So make sure this is a fund that you want to be associated with. Mm-hmm. And if we feel like we're saying something that needs to be hidden, that's a problem. And so we ask founders to hold us accountable and make sure that, you know, we're seeing things with the from the right perspective. We may still arrive at a different decision. We still may most of the time say that we're not going to fund you, but we try to be thoughtful about how we arrive at that decision with their help to avoid the conscious and subconscious bias, and also to be more transparent about how we have made this decision so that you can determine whether we're a good fit for you or not.
Right. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you on a lot of these observations. And it's a difficult space when it comes to interviewing in general. It's very challenging because it's a muscle that you have to build by doing that over and over. And it's a lot of self-discovery through the process as well. Amen. How you do that? What are some of the things that you encounter in terms of that decision-making process? So to me, that's very fascinating. So thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. You've been in this space for quite some time. You've had your share of mentors, coaches, and things like that. What are the best pieces of advice that you have received, or maybe, you know, a series of those recommendations and advice that you continue giving on to those whom you coach and mentor?
You know, honestly, the thing that, and I have been blessed, you know, to learn from a lot of wonderful people. And I continue, you know, to take that mentorship, certainly. And I hope to do that for the remainder of my life. I think for me, it always comes back down to seeking to live in congruence with, you know, everything, you know, the people and everything that populate the planet. And that's true for personal and professional. It's about seeking fit. It's about being self-aware about who you are and what's important to you and who you want to become and the journey that you want to take and the things that attract you and the things that repel you. And invite people to nurture themselves towards you or away from you based on whether there's congruence or not, whether there's a fit. And to realize that life doesn't exist in parallel lines where people are and always will be either a good fit or not a good fit. but that more like a, you know, a sine wave. And throughout our existence, we become, and you know, more or less of a good fit over time. That's as true for personal relationships as it is co-founder relationships, as it is customer and vendor relationships. And so seeking fit, and for me, the best way to seek fit is to be transparent. That's why it's one of our core values. To us, there's nothing that promotes long-term, healthy, sustainable, nonviolent relationships than transparency. And I use that word nonviolent and people chuckle. You know, not, violence is not just physical. You know, I'm talking about definitionally a violent relationship, something that's not incongruent, something that is going to, where one set of that relationship is subjugating priorities to the other set of that relationship. And so, you know, whether it's customer development, whether it's personal development, you know, or otherwise, it's about seeking fit. It's about, you know, defining the characteristics of what attracts you and what repels you and what you're looking to do and how you're looking to do it. And knowing that everything communicates so that everything that you do is, you know, your promise of experience. Mm-hmm. To me, that is the definition of brand. Is whether it's my personal brand or GrowthX's brand, that is the promise of experience of Andrew or the promise of experience with GrowthX. And so we communicate directly by telling you what our core values are, but we communicate more importantly by going about our profession and behaving in a way that is either consistent or inconsistent with those core values. And ultimately, over time, there is a promise of experience that we either live up to or fall short on. And we are fallible, and so we will make mistakes, but we ask that we build trustful relationships where feedback is a gift and we can improve over time. But being transparent with all of that and inviting people to determine whether or not I or we are a good fit based on that is to me how you build long-term, sustainable, healthy, nonviolent relationships. And to me, that's advice that you can apply to any relationship writ large.
Well, you've definitely closed this conversation on a very powerful note. So I appreciate that advice, and that recommendation definitely resonates on so many levels. And just overall, Andrew, can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short and insightful conversation. Personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with a lot of the guests on Ivy Podcast to do a follow-up recording in about a year, where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if everything we've discussed still applies, still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I would look forward to that very much. I like that approach, Simon. Thank you. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be talking with you and have an opportunity to reach your audience. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.